Welcome to East Meets West, episode 255. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And I am back from Nerdtacular, there where Roger Chang was not.
I was not there. I was conscious and avoiding that. Actually, no, I was. We had to shoot a show that day, so I did not
say
leave.
On the panel that I was glad you weren't there.
That's good. That's good to say. It's good to air that.
You know, I just wanted to get it out there, make it clear.
That's fine.
Let people know this is
let the history book show that Tom Merritt is a jerk.
It was really fun. This was the first year that Scott organized Nerdtacular as more of a conference and less of a meetup. Because it really started as a meetup. It started as a bunch of people getting together to watch a movie, and then it grew into watching a movie and then afterwards giving away prizes and having a little talk. And this year it's like there was no movie. It was in an events center, and he had three or four panels scheduled.
That's cool. Where did it take place?
Noah's Event Center in South Jordan, Utah, which is a suburb of Salt Lake City.
The Event Center.
Yeah, so it was actually Reception Center. So it was like this little... It's kind of thing that you could see somebody, you know, having a big old wedding reception in or a business conference or something like that. There was a main hall that held about 500 people, and it was pretty full. And then there were little conference rooms and boardrooms scattered throughout.
Boardrooms. The rooms must have been really bored.
There was one room was like a theater, so he had episodes of cartoons playing in that room constantly. There was a volleyball court where kids were going and playing volleyball, which is kind of like a precursor to racquetball.
Oh, like kids, squash. Kids,
yeah, yeah. And then upstairs there was sort of a larger room that was set out with tables for vendors showing off their apps and different services and kind of like a trade show floor. There's probably around a dozen different tables there, and they were selling T-shirts and stuff.
Cool. What'd you get?
He had several panels. He had a podcasters panel for all the Frog Pants podcasters. He had a game show, trivia show that I was on. He had a panel for video game podcasters. They did a live episode of Film Sack. And then there was something called Prizeocalypse, where he just gave away, for an hour, just gave away prizes.
Would you win me?
I was not eligible to win, as I am a Frog Pants podcaster.
Yeah, interesting. All right, I'll let it go this time, Merritt.
You should come next year. It was fun.
Well, I when Veronica was telling me about it, it's like I can't because I have to shoot a show that day, and then because everyone's out this following week, so we're doubling up, tripling up in some cases.
Plan for it next year.
Okay, I will.
You seem to be able to make it to Comic-Con.
That is I've been doing that since my last job.
Yeah, but you don't say, oh, I can't go to Comic-Con, I have to do a shoot.
No, I don't. I tell other people to do the shoot.
Now, there you go, see? So you can do that for Nerdtacular.
No, there was too much at stake. Well, this year. I'll do it next year.
Next year is going to be bigger and better.
Cool. As long as there's a buffet table.
There was food. I wouldn't call it a buffet table. We actually we didn't buy the food at the events center. We went to In-N-Out.
In-N-Out.
That's what a hamburger's all about.
Yes. You know, it's hard to find a good burger these days, I must say.
Is it?
Burgers that don't either taste greasy, burnt, or just, I don't know.
Well, for In-N-Out me, is a good burger.
You know,
it's hard to find In-N-Out?
No. In-N-Out's a good fast food burger. I wouldn't call it a great burger. I know that would be some sort of sacrilege.
Wait, what kind of burger are you talking? You want a fine dining burger?
No, I just there's something about after I eat an In-N-Out burger, I think it tastes fine. But the way it makes me feel later, it's a little different.
That has nothing to do with the burger. That's you. Your stomach just has issues.
Oh, my stomach. Well, yeah.
So there are burgers you eat that don't make you feel bloated and nauseous later?
Well, not nauseous, yeah. And generally, I've actually eaten burgers that made me, I would feel full, but I wouldn't feel bloated or like, ugh.
Because In-N-Out burgers never make me or anyone else I know feel that way.
Well, that's fine. Maybe you guys have a gene that...
What do
that
you get on your In-N-Out burger?
Nothing. I just get lettuce, tomato, onions. I don't get mayo. I don't get cheese. I just get the patty.
In-N-Out burgers always treat me right.
Maybe.
Well, maybe
once your deal with them is over, they'll put back the secret ingredient that causes me.
Deal with them?
I don't know.
I don't have a deal with them. What are you talking about? I wish I had a deal with them.
Oh,
get free burgers.
Pay me in burgers.
Yeah.
Keep your money. Pay me in wheelbarrows full of your double doubles.
So what is your acceptable burger that does not make you feel nauseous?
I had one, actually the burgers are over at, Just For You. It's a diner over by my work. It doesn't make me feel that way. It actually makes me feel fine when I'm done eating.
What do they do? Have you asked?
I don't know. I need to ask. I need to find out. I honestly think it's just the cooking grease. It might be just as simple as that. Like
you can't handle a lot of fat.
No, it's not the fat. It's certain types of cooking oil will probably do it to me.
In-N-Out isn't cooked in oil, though. It's just cooked in its own bacon or its own burger grease.
In its own bacon grease?
Yeah.
No, I'm sure they have to use some sort of cooking oil somewhere.
No, a good burger doesn't, and I'm pretty sure they don't. That's their whole thing at In-N-Out is like, we don't add anything.
Well, that's not adding.
Potatoes are fresh. And they're just potatoes.
Yeah, and they got it deep fried in something. What do they fry it in?
Well,
air?
The potatoes are deep fried in oil, but they're not. But the burgers aren't.
They're not. When you cook a burger on the grill, you add a little bit, just a little bit, so it doesn't stick.
Well, maybe they do, but that's not how I cook my burgers.
Well, you know what? Perhaps you should open a chain of burger restaurants.
Maybe I will start. You know, I've been grilling a lot. I got the grill going last weekend.
Is it a gas or a charcoal grill?
It is a propane grill.
You know, there's
ceramic briquettes.
There's quite the allegiance to propane versus charcoal.
I've always grilled on charcoal my whole life, but when we moved into this place, there was a propane grill here, and so instead of having to go out and buy a grill, I could use the propane grill. So that's why I'm doing propane. It's not the same. They're two different things. So a propane grill is more of like cooking in a kitchen to me, whereas a charcoal grill is more of an art of I have to get the charcoal to the right consistency and before I put the meat on and feel the heat and then find the hot spots and all of that. Propane grill makes that a lot easier. It's uniform. You light it, it starts. You just got to wait for it to heat up.
It's the difference between a stick shift and an automatic.
It is kind of, yeah. And I'm not saying that one is worse or better than the other. They're just different. The charcoal takes a lot more time and is a lot more complex, and it's a lot easier to mess up. And it gives you the benefit of, a charcoaly, smoky, woody flavor to your burgers, sure. But if you're not cooking them properly, then that doesn't really matter. Propane is easier to use. Not that you can't mess it up, but it's harder to mess up. It gives you a nice even flavor and a control. And you can put those ceramic briquettes that give it a little bit of a grilled flavor. But it's saying that propane grills are bad is like saying ovens are bad. I mean, I cook steaks in an oven and they're just fine, even though they don't have that smoky charcoaly goodness.
You cook steaks in the oven?
Sure.
I mean, I shouldn't be one to talk. I bake everything I eat.
Why don't you never cooked a steak in an oven? You broil them.
I broil it, but I don't.
That's in an oven.
Well, yeah, but you have to use the broiler part of the oven.
Not in some ovens. Not in any oven that I have ever owned, honestly.
All right.
You just broil in the oven.
Okay.
Boy, you don't know anything. But in and out, sure, broiling.
Yeah. All right, Tom.
You live such a sheltered life, Roger.
Truly, I've mistaken your vast talents in the culinary field.
Saying anything I cook is any good. Let me just be clear about that.
Your chicken tastes like your steak.
My chicken tastes like wood, but I do know that I can broil in an oven. We actually grilled fish the other day. That is the one thing that I do take a little pride in.
I like grilling fish is actually still one of my favorite ways to prepare it. Because
now, how do you do it? Because I have my own way of doing it, but I'm always looking for good ways.
Well, so this is what you know we do in the restaurant. I lightly once you get the fish fillet or steak or whatever, I lightly oil it with whatever I usually in the kitchen. It's usually olive oil or something, and I just set it on the grill for a short time, enough to see where the meat is cooked, but not all the way. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I like this more than, like, say, broiling or whatever is because, to be honest, grilling's a good way to get the kind of fishy taste. Like, I like fish, but I'm not big on, you know, the more stronger flavored fishes or fish. So if you cook it, the fat kind of drips off, which contains a lot of that flavor, which some people love and I kind of like cringe away from. And it makes certain fish that I normally wouldn't eat a lot more palatable. Mm. Now, this is one thing I picked up from do you remember David Yount back at Tech Team? Oh, yeah. So we were at one of Marcus Buick's famed barbecues. And what he did was, you know, of course you had the citrus juice on top, but he also added like a bit of tequila. And generally, I don't like tequila. I don't like the aftertaste, but it made the fish taste pretty darn good. I'm not sure just because of the alcohol or whatever.
Well,
but
the alcohol cooks off, but chemically changes the fish a bit. And
but it actually worked out pretty well. It's just tequila is expensive, and it's not something you want to liberally apply to a fish.
Well, unless you know, true. Like to live high on the fish.
High on the fish.
When you put it on the grill, do you just throw it on? Do you treat it some way? Do you wrap it?
Depending, normally if it's a pretty stocky fish where the meat the flesh isn't too won't flake off too quickly, I'll leave it on there. Like say halibut,
like a halibut steak, or tuna.
I'll grill it straight on. If it's something a little more delicate, I'll put it in foil.
I always wrap it in foil, even if it's halibut or swordfish or something like that. We did steelhead trout.
I'm just waiting for all the people to write it. You guys can't cook.
Oh, that's fine. No, we as with every episode of East Meets West, we do not put ourselves out as experts in anything that we talk about. We're just talking about stuff. So if you've got recommendations, corrections, by all means, subbrilliant.com/EMW, put them in the comments. What I do with my fish though, and it usually works pretty well. I wrap it up in aluminum foil with sometimes butter, although I haven't been doing that lately. Pepper, onions, and garlic, and then I just let the fish cook in its own juices.
Yeah, I try to stay. I've been very conscientious about not adding butter to anything I cook.
It's one of those things I've gotten away from. When I first started doing it, you know, back in my 20s, I would always stick some butter in there, you know.
Back in your football days when you had to bulk up for the season.
Yeah, what? No. But then, yeah, as I started to get older and more weight conscious, health conscious, I realized, you know, the butter really isn't necessary. It's the pepper that helps the flavor. And so to replace the butter is when I started putting onions and garlic in there. And that permeates pretty well. And I don't know. It always turns out great for some reason on the grill.
I think it's because you might be a little more cognizant of it. You're like you're a little more doting on it than if you just kind of stuck it in the oven.
So you think it's just psychological? You don't think there's any difference in the taste?
It could also be, you know, grills cook differently. So
I think it's that. Because I mean, if the other people that I'm with are either skeptical or neutral on the idea of grilled fish, and then when they eat it, they're like, oh my God, this is great.
No, grilling fish is one of the best ways to cook fish, I think.
I think it steams it a little because it's wrapped in aluminum foil.
It's true.
And you don't do that in the oven. I guess if you just wrapped it in aluminum foil in the oven, it might do the same thing.
I will say that if I make some drawn butter, I'll lightly apply it after it's done, but I won't. I just there's a thing about me and just adding too much to food initially. Like some people, I think overly season their barbecue.
You mean salt?
Yes.
Yeah. You always say overly season when you mean salt.
Yes.
You're just being nice.
Well, I think it's also because they might be smokers, and smokers tend to, I personally believe, have a duller sense of taste.
You always say that. I'm just saying.
You have
these beliefs that you just pound at.
Yes.
And have been for years. It's hilarious.
Yes.
We go to a restaurant, if something's salty, Roger goes, the cook must be a smoker.
Probably. I'm just saying. You know, it's
people aren't smokers. They're just not very good.
Maybe, but you know, it's one of those things I've just noticed, just having worked with a lot of cooks in my dad's place, that the ones that tend to overseason everything are the ones that go out the back at the end of the day.
It does make sense. I got to give you that.
I never thought about it until one of the waitresses is like, yeah, you know, a lot of cooks that smoke tend to overly salt to certain things because they're trying to get that taste, but they can't because, you know. Yeah,
early on in my life, I decided I was not going to cook with salt. And it was in college. I was talking to a couple of people, and they were like, oh, yeah, I never put salt. That's a crutch. If you can make your food taste good without salt, then you're really doing something well. I've gotten much softer on that idea. I will use salt, but I use it very sparingly. I don't add it to my grilled fish. I barely add it to grilled meats. Usually what I do is I buy some kind of dry rub, and there's salt in it, and so I don't add any other salt than that. But I don't like to salt stuff because while it is an important season, it's not. It's kind of the easy season, and it's easy to overdo it.
I've just been with a lot of people who I've seen when they cooked less, you know, especially red meat, like, you know, like steaks and stuff like that. I always ask them, you know, do you add anything? It's like, some people really like to dry rub. It's like, I don't. I just believe in cooking it well enough that it should be flavorful by itself, is what they keep telling me or what I've been told.
Yeah.
And it's not that you shouldn't use any, but it should be there to add an accent, but not mask or overwhelm the flavor of the food you actually
are. Absolutely. I mean, I do cook meats without dry rub quite often if I think that looks like a particularly good cut. I think it's going to cook up fine. But then sometimes you just want that. Like, oh, you know, I'm in the mood for something a little peppery, you know? And even the dry rub, you want to use it sparingly. You can really overdo it if you, like, you know, you don't want to crust your meat in it. I
don't like to be a snob, but I'm not. I've kind of gone away from your standard kind of pepper. Like your pepper that's already ground in the supermarket. I like fresh ground pepper because
it doesn't
taste stale to me. Like if you use the stuff that comes out of like a salt and pepper shaker, it just tastes stale.
Again, that makes sense because you've opened up the pepper and it's going to dry.
You've opened up the pepper.
Yeah, I mean, I still think it tastes fine, but I do think fresh ground pepper tastes better.
Yeah, if I could, I used to have a little pepper grinder, but I think I lost in my last move many years.
That's one of the things that's become common in the past, I don't know, 5-10 years. You could buy whole peppercorns in a little plastic bottle that has a grinder. Now, granted, it's probably not the best grinder in the world, but, you know, when I've been on vacation and sometimes you stay in a house or a cabin or something and you run to the grocery store, that's always something that's in the cabin that I check for is whether they have that little, you know,
thing of pepper
grinder thing. And if they don't, I try to buy one at the grocery store so that you actually get that. They also have that same kind of grinder, a little plastic dealie for sea salt.
Oh, huh. I've never seen the sea salt.
That makes much of a difference. That may be more of a
game. I mean, sea salt's just a mineral, so does it have a freshness rating?
I guess, well, you know, if anything, it would keep it from getting humid.
That's true.
Because
we used to, for our sugar shakers in the restaurant, you know, the ones people use to pour for coffee and stuff, we used to put a couple of saltine crackers in there.
I've also seen rice used in that way. You just put some grains of rice in there to absorb the water.
Works out pretty well. I was pretty impressed. It doesn't clump up or anything.
Do you have any tricks for the ketchup bottle?
Yeah, I take it. I make sure the top is secured, and I just kind of wing it around like in a centrifugal motion to kind of force it to the top. And then I slowly open the top and pour it out. The other one, was it Josh Brentano taught me, was to hit the number 5 on the Heinz. But, you know, they all come now in those little upside-down plastic bottles.
Yeah. You the just squeeze bottle kind of changed ketchup pouring forever.
I know. It's a pretty ingenious invention. I'm amazed it didn't come out sooner. I remember when you had to refill, tomato, or ketchup bottles using the old can, and you have to undo the top, like the giant cans.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I was talking to Jen about this earlier in the day. It's like, you remember the time when you had to open punch and fruit juices, and you had to make the little, it came in a tin can and you had to make two holes on either side.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, wow, it's like, how far have we progressed? And now we have this high impact plastic that we put all our juices in. Before, you had to stick in this tin can. If you didn't finish it, you had to stick in the fridge, or more likely put it into a craft bottle because you don't want the tinny taste with the juice or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I just, the more I look back on on the stuff I did as a kid, it's just kind of bizarre.
Well, I can't believe how much caffeinated soda I was allowed to drink as a child. I mean, my soda was controlled up until a point when I was 11 or 12, but then I was old enough to just go get in the fridge and grab a drink myself. And, instead of stocking healthy drinks, my parents just had Pepsis and Coke and Nestea, and that's what I drank. And I look at it, I'm like, oh my God, I'm surprised my growth wasn't stunted by all that caffeine.
You know, my dad made sure that I didn't drink any soda that wasn't 7-Up. Because 7-Up's whole thing was no caffeine, never had it, never will. Remember they had
the Uncola.
No, that was Like. That was their cola.
No, 7-Up was the Uncola.
Then what was Like?
Like had something similar.
But Like was a product of 7-Up, and right. It was their first cola product. Real Cola Nut. They had the real cola nut in it or something like that. It's really bizarre. But it too didn't have any caffeine. And my dad was very adamant that I not drink any caffeine while growing up. I think it's the whole kind of...
And yet I'm taller than you.
I chalk that up to mutated vegetables when you're growing up or something. Pesticides. Lots and lots of pesticides.
So pesticides are good for you.
They can be. Certain people. Chemical imbalance here, chemical imbalance there. Thunk, your thyroid condition, and now you're 6'1".
You know, and then the thing is now we're facing another food crisis. We've been doing East Meets West long enough to have gone through one food crisis and live to see another. We were talking about this back in 2008. The food shortages and the food prices. Yep. And
rising food prices. This is the big one, and it's due to a multitude of factors.
Yeah, you're right. It's not a shortage. I should correct myself. It's a food price problem, which is causing shortages of supply because people can't afford it, not because there isn't enough food. Yeah,
and it's really interesting. I was just reading up on this article, and I'm trying to remember. Maybe it was in The Age or something, and there was concern by the – I wasn't sure if it was the Australian – federal or the state government concerned about foreign interests buying up prime farmland, and it just covered specifically Australia, but I remember reading an Economist article on the same topic where a lot of countries, be it from the Middle East, European countries, or companies or North American companies were buying prime farmland in Australia, and Africa was a big one. And it was, in China buying big swaths of prime agricultural land in Africa as well. And it was all basically to ensure a steady flow of moderately priced foodstuffs. I was noticing the parallel in the same way that, for the longest time, a lot of people or a lot of nations made sure that access to moderately priced petroleum was in their country's best interest because, you can't grow an economy without energy. And still, the primary energy that everyone uses is petroleum-based. But now, your food is also becoming one of those big – big scarcity items that countries are investing in. It's if the land isn't you know, in the Middle East, there's not a lot of, you know, agricultural land that you have access to. Why not buy it in a part of the world that does, and super cheap?
One of the problems is not that we don't have enough land to grow the food on, but we actually aren't using it to grow food. And there were criticism of this the last time we had a food crisis. And again, people are saying it's irresponsible to be growing biofuels on land that should be used to grow food when we have these food prices.
Well, it's interesting because even countries like India that still suffer from a great deal of malnourishment exports a lot of wheat. You know, they export a lot of agricultural products. I mean, you know, it's one of those things. Do people just keep producing until everyone's fed, or do they produce what's in their best interest?
Well, it's a world food market. India is exporting wheat because it's a world food market, and they can get more for the wheat
exactly.
and import other foods. So it's not very helpful to look at individual countries in this. The problem is that there's just not as much food on the market as there should be. And especially for lower priced, you know, staples like grains. And so the prices are going up because in a lot of cases, land is being devoted to growing corn or you know, sugar cane. And then being sold to biofuels. And that's not to say that biofuels are bad, but, you know, if there's more money going to biofuels, then people are going to buy that food for that, which leaves less to be eaten.
You know, I'm curious to see in terms of raw tonnage of foods available, you know, on the open market, because, you know, one of the things we're missing, of course, is the population has increased, you know, even from a decade ago. And, you know, now there are estimates that's going to, you know, peak at 10 plus billion, you know, in the next 100 years or a little under 100 years. And it'll be interesting. I mean, it's you know, there's going to be this huge dynamic change where, you know, you're going to have to feed all these people. But, you know, with so many different parts of the world more interested in generating a profit, you know, hard currency and stuff, you know, for example, like India, you know, are those people going to foment some sort of, you know, civil unrest in much the same way in North Africa? You know, was it in Tunisia that started off with a lot of complaints about rising food costs? You know, people just simply couldn't afford the food. People were frustrated and angry, and eventually that kind of coalesced into a larger political, I guess you could call it a political movement.
Because farmers halfway across the world are selling their crops to other people who are not going to use them as foodstuffs, you see revolts in North Africa and the Middle East.
No, I'm not saying that.
That is essentially true. It's oversimplifying it. Because it's not the only reason there were revolts in Tunisia and Egypt and the continuing.
But it was the straw that broke.
It was one of the pillars that motivated people.
And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, other than the Depression, I don't really think there's a period in at least, you know, American, you know, recent memory where people ran short on food.
And the developed world is not going to run short on food. There's enough money there. Where this hits is in developing countries where they rely on the cheaper foodstuffs and the staples. And as the price of those goes up, people can't afford it. You know, a loaf of bread gets expensive, and then people can't afford to feed themselves.
Well, you know, one of the comments that a lot of sociologists have made about, you know, obesity in America being mainly a poor socioeconomically, a poorer phenomenon than a richer phenomenon, was that, you know, poor people lived in areas that didn't have access to affordable, quote unquote, you know, food stuff. They would go to fast food restaurants because it was cheap, but not necessarily healthy. And, you know, I it's not that I believe in one way or the other, but, you know, it was pointed out that in richer communities, people tended to weigh less and have healthier lifestyles, and that money would allow them to do certain things in order to keep.
There's a lot of theories about that. There's theories that it has to do with the food additives in cheaper foods, things like maltodextrin and the, you know, and the sugary type preservatives, and starches and stiffeners. There's also theory about hormones being used in the growing, of meats and that, you know, when those meats are eaten at fast food restaurants, you know, that those hormones may be causing glandular issues, which cause obesity. But the fact remains that you're in the socioeconomic status, it's the obesity is a bigger problem, so to speak, amongst the poorer socioeconomic statuses than among the richer ones. So there's something to buying cheap food that causes obesity, is my guess.
Yeah, you know, and it's, it, I mean, it's so complex, and there's so many variables that, you know, it's one of those things where everyone wants to find a simple silver bullet solution. You know, whether it's
the debt. That's not true. Everybody doesn't want to find a simple silver bullet solution. The media and the consumers of the media want that. There's plenty of people out there who, in responsible positions, who understand it's complex and are trying to reach a solution that takes into account that complexity. The problem is that the folks discussing it who aren't involved want it to be explained simply. That's what's going to have to change. That we could do a whole other episode just on that problem itself.
Agreed. We should do another episode.
We should do another episode one of these days, but that's it for this episode. Thanks, Roger.
Sure. Did my voice crack?
Yeah, you're finally getting puberty. It's so cute. Thanks, everybody, for listening or watching. You can make your comments about our cooking or the food shortages at sobrilliant.com/EMW. Appreciate Francis was the only one who commented on the irritable Chang syndrome.
But there was two. That's right. He commented twice,
talking about Generation Y and his theories on generation. So thanks, Francis.
That's awesome.
Sobrilliant.com/EMW for your comments. We will see you next time.
Bye.
About this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.